Welcome to Folkways, the Folklore of Britain and Ireland podcast. A very warm welcome to the show. Today, we're heading to Loch Sween, Argyll, where there is meant to be a doorway to the other world. Let's take a look, shall we? Sween, mid Argyll, Scotland, is a tranquil sea loch, and its name originates from the Mac Sween, or Clan Sweeney, which means well-disposed or pleasant in Scottish Gaelic. Nestled within a safeguarded national nature reserve, amidst the captivating hills of Knapdale and a rare ancient temperate rainforest. When in this neck of the woods, the Fairy Isles at the head of Loch Sween might be one of the first places we think of in reference to the otherworldly, the good people, the Sidhe. As we sweep over the top of this striking temperate rainforest, we note, however, that this isn't our final stop today, but rather another area of the loch. To learn more, we're going to open a copy of The Kist, the magazine of the Natural History and Antiquarian Society of Mid-Argyll, issue number 21 of Spring 1981, written by D.M. Houghton and A.T. Lewis. South of the gate that gives access down to Castle Sween, the road to Kilmory Knap continues along the hillside without much variation for the next 2 miles. If the road itself is rather dull here, the views from it become more and more spectacular. Looking back, Castle Sween on its rocky knoll on the shore occupies the foreground, and Loch Sween, stretching back into the hills of North Knapdale, KNAP, provides a scene that in storm or calm, sun or rain, summer green or the rich golden browns of winter, is never twice the same. Westward, the road overlooks the narrowest part of the loch and the lowland beyond, which here is the island of Dana, though it is joined to the mainland by a causeway. The little fields, copses and rough ground take a lovely pattern of colour as a foreground for the mountains of Jura across the sound, which now begin to show west of Dana. There is a good strip of fertile land, and here are a number of ruined cottages in two groups. This is Doid. In former times, there must have been a good many people living here. Now, only one of the old houses is still in use. At the seaward side of the area is a smooth hump of rock which falls away to the loch side as a splintered cliff, and when the fern and bracken have died in winter from among the many massive fallen slabs, it is clear to see that this place was used as a quarry for flat stones for doorsteps and lintels. Archaeologists and geologists are now certain that this site provided the stone for many of the crosses and grave slabs carved in Mid-Argyll centuries ago. This green strip ends in a sandy bay. Good crops must have been grown at Doid a century ago, and John MacTaggart, the weaver of Knapp, told us how the boats came from Northern Ireland to buy potatoes here. We first met John in the late 1920s. He said he was 88 then, and he lived for another 4 years. He told us much about the district and impressed upon us children then how every place had its own name and its story. We remember much of what he told us and often wish we'd had the chance to learn more from him. It is the next account the authors give that is of real interest. In the 1950s, John MacTaggart's nephew Dougal, who spent a good deal of time at Knapp after he retired, told our parents another tale about Doid. This concerns the small, steep rock face at the east roadside just at the start of the hill going on to Kilmorey Knapp. There is an old milestone there on the left, just an upright slab of stone about 2 feet high, 18 miles, it reads, to Loch Gilphead. The numbers were still painted on it in the 1920s, but never renewed since. Almost above this, the rock formation looks like a doorway. There is a flat lintel and a recess below with the appearance of door jambs on either side. All is rather overgrown now with grass and scrub, but it is possible to imagine it cleared and then quite impressive. This is called the Door na Sí, the Door of the Fairies, and is a way into the hill for the good people who dwell there, story says. A tradition exists that they, capital T, are sometimes heard singing. Dougal, John MacTaggart's nephew, admitted that he had once heard them and that he had known others who had. He thought that it rarely happened.
You have to be right, and the time has to be right,
he said. The occurrence had evidently made a great impression on him. The article continues. When my mother told me about this tale, I felt quite queer about it, as my mind at once returned to a strange winter dusk early in 1941, when I was living at Kilmorey Knapp with two tiny children evacuated from the south. It was a Sunday, and I had a lift 4 miles along the road to Craigmadie Farm to get my baby's milk, which came on weekdays by post van. The light was fading, I remember, as I walked home past Doid, and heard an odd sound, like a short cadence of notes every now and then. I kept stopping to hear it better. Then there was silence. But as soon as I moved on again and my footsteps were sounding once more on the road, I'd hear it again. I could not make it out. It seemed in the air without direction, a far sound, yet coming from nowhere. I think I must have heard it 20 or 30 times while I walked that piece of road, and I am sure that after I passed that rock, that doorway, and went on up the hill, I heard it no more. It puzzled me at the time, but I had no one to ask about it, and I forgot. It was 10 or 12 years later that I heard about the door in the hill and of the singing, and instantly I thought about that evening again. There may be an explanation. I've tried to find one, but have failed to do so. Of one thing I am certain, that what I heard was the same sound that gave rise to the legend, if I may call it that. It is a lasting regret that I never had a chance to tell Dougal what I had heard or to ask him about it myself. I've been back in the district a good many years now, but that hillside has remained silent and the door locked very firmly shut, bolted and barred against the noises of internal combustion engines. This was in the end of the Kist's covering of Doid and the stone doorway. Pat Doherty revisits Loch Sween with the article Strange Happenings. This is issue number 85. When we first moved to Kilmorey Knapp over 12 years ago, I was intrigued by reports of strange musical sounds or singing having been heard at times by people living there before and up to the 1950s. The sounds were associated with a stretch of road in the vicinity of the rock outcrop known locally as the Fairy Door or Fairy Castle. Later, when looking for any written accounts connected to these events, I came across an article in an earlier edition of Kist, issue 21, which we have just covered. In Dalriada, a 20th century kingdom, Marion Pallister refers to legends and superstitions as the stuff of islands and peninsulas that in Mid-Argyll hang, like Ulva, to the mainland by a thread. The fact that such were manifest, told and passed on to others, speaks to me of a deep connection at that time between the people who lived and farmed in Knapdale and with every aspect of their environment. Sadly, with social change, this quality has for the most part become lost. The area of Kilmorey Knapp has become peopled in the main by tourists and urban dwellers who reside only periodically in this part of Argyll. Many, nevertheless, claim long-standing affiliations with and attachments to the area, often the result of returning year after year for holidays. The article continues with a name that translates from the Scottish Gaelic to Scott the Storyteller, who wrote an article entitled The Old Faith. Within the older culture of the so-called Celtic peoples, there is a particular viewpoint on matters metaphysical. Included within this system of beliefs are such topics as second sight, the fairies or the wee folk, and a reverence for signs and patterns in nature. Scott goes on to say how this very ancient culture was still surviving in Mid-Argyll within living memory. The article continues, in looking into this topic, I came across further handed down tales relating to other aspects of these beliefs. However, for this article, I intend to mention just a few which suggest evidence of beliefs around fairies or the wee folk in Mid-Argyll. So after reading the earlier Kist article about fairy music being heard, an emigre of Knapp, Dermot A. Campbell, wrote to the Natural History and Antiquarian Society on the 2nd of August 1981. Here is an extract from his letter.
Some years ago, my brother and sister had a similar experience when walking over to the Standing Stone halfway down the Craigness side of the Black Moor. The one generally known as the Danish Prince's Grave. First, they thought it was from a transistor or car radio, but there was no one below, and the music faded as they got away from the stone. They could not clearly identify it, describing it as eerie, and got back to their car rather quickly.
Other references to the Wee Folk occurred in interviews carried out for the Dalriada project and can be accessed in the local archives or the School of Scottish Studies. I understand that at the time, many Gaelic words and phrases were still used in this relatively isolated community and further afield. In one of the Dalriada interviews, Donald Shuttleworth, who is related to many families in Mid Argyll and who spent his school holidays at Kilmory Knapp, where his grandfather farmed, told the interviewer that as local people passed the fairy door, they would whisper,
"God protect the wee folk. God bless the wee folk."
As he did himself. Some, Donald said, believed quite sincerely in the existence of the wee folk. Archie Jenkins was one of them. Another, old Mr. McTaggart of the road end of Kilmory Knapp, is recalled as having come in one night, saying,
"I had a lovely time whilst listening to the Sherries."
Apparently, that was what he always called them. The translation provided for this word that he always used is ever-living ones.
"I had a lovely time whilst listening to the Sherries."
His son, Angus MacTaggart, then went down to the sea himself, and sure enough, he heard this lovely lilting. A long time has passed, but I hope there may be people native to and still living in Mid Argyll who could add more knowledge and perhaps share further memories of a culture in which beliefs and values contrasted so sharply with those of the present day. End of article. I hope you enjoyed this look at the Kist Zine's spotlighting of this area in two separate issues. The point of this episode hasn't been to encourage listeners en masse to visit this location necessarily. For one, good luck finding it, and I do mean that. The whole place is overgrown with dead bracken and grass, so you may not know when you've found it at all. I do just make this point to warn people who think that, yeah, they might quite like to quickly visit for 10 minutes or so on their way to somewhere else, for example. It's not that kind of a gig, and that's all I'll say on it. The point I really want to make, though, is that this type of tale, so a particular patch of land that has an otherworldly significance, the Dor na Sidhe in this episode, this is extremely common in folklore. So the issue is that, as Pat Doherty said in the article, Strange Happenings, is that this has stopped being popular knowledge. It may surprise you to learn that wherever you're sitting or standing right now, potentially not that far away, there are culturally sensitive or once celebrated and feared points of the landscape. Remember John MacTaggart's insistence in the first 1980s Kist article that every place has its name and story. Evidently, this doesn't just apply to Lough Sween, but your current location too. The article authors D.M. Houghton and A.T. Lewis express what I read as a certain level of regret, it seems, that they didn't converse more with John and his nephew, Dougal. So we do need new blood. We do need people with hearts beating now who know something of their local stories. Whether we approach this from a historical, social, or spiritual, sacred perspective. I imagine that perhaps you are one such person. This episode makes an excellent addition to my season 2 work on The Other World. I created this series as something of a starter pack, if you like. It's certainly not comprehensive, but I thought it would allow me to build upon it in years to come. Today's show is particularly relevant to my work on liminality and on fairy music, which you can both find in the Otherworld series. Happy listening. You've been listening to Folkways, the Folklore of Britain and Ireland podcast, written and produced by myself, Ashley. Music by Big Big Sky. Find him on socials and streaming platforms at big.big.sky. Be sure to connect with the show on Instagram at Folkways Channel. Stay tuned for this month's almanac, which will be coming up shortly. If you'd like to hear the almanac before anyone else, be sure to head to Folkways' YouTube channel, which you'll find linked in the show notes, where the almanac is uploaded as an individual video at the beginning of each month. If you'd like the Folkways tree to grow and bear fruit, please consider watering its roots. This episode was made possible by the Friends of Folkways. Friends are excellent humans who chip in to help me afford the books I buy for each episode. If you think preserving this work is a worthwhile endeavour, you can join the Friends from only £2 a month, in return receiving instrumental soundtracks, letters in the post, and meditations. Sharing it with a pal or leaving a good rating wherever you're listening to this also helps the show to grow. Thank you. Warmest of welcomes imaginable to January 2024. A very happy new year to you. So, January, this word, it relates to the Roman god Janus, god of beginnings, endings, doorways, and passages. Janus is depicted as having two faces, one looking to the future, whilst the other looks to the past at the same time. In Irish, January is Anna, and in Welsh, Ianuar, which are both a direct borrowing from the Latin. Scots Gaelic, Imferloch, Wolf Month, Cornish, Mis Genver, Manx, Jerry Gowry, and Old English, Aftera Eula, which we looked at last month. So it is as miserable as sin out there. What do we do after Twelfth Night to keep the blues at bay? Well, we wassail, of course. These days, most wassails take place after the new year, stretching from January through to March, and they can be seen as a way of introducing a little post-Christmas communal magic, if you like, in the dark and gloomy days before the sun appears to be returning to us. The word wassail comes from the Middle English toast, wassail, meaning be thou hail, which in turn means be in good health. And the phrase wassail does date back to pre-Norman times, so if you do decide to get outside and do a bit of wassailing, you will be following a time-honoured tradition indeed. And if someone says wassail to you, the appropriate response is drink hail, or drink to their good health. But we see that was hailing is more than just a greeting. So originally, the wassail was actually a drink, and it was made of mulled ale, and then things like curdled cream, apples, eggs, cloves, ginger, nutmeg, and sugar. And it was served from these huge bowls, often made of silver or pewter. But more than this, it's drunk as part of an ancient English Yuletide ritual and salutation. One either knocks on people's doors and they sing, or we have the orchard visiting wassail, where the apple trees are actually sung to ensure an abundant following harvest. So whilst the door-to-door singing has basically been displaced by caroling, there are an ever-growing amount of orchard wassails today. Keep your eyes peeled as there may be one happening near you, and if you don't find one is happening, why not take this as inspiration to organise one for next year? Wassail to you, be in good health. Okay, drum roll. We are going for the S's, S for sugar, for 2024. If you woke up in Sunderland, northeast England, at the beginning of January, you saw the sunrise at 8:30 and set at 15:50, giving a day of 7 hours and 20 minutes. Swansea, South Wales, you saw the sunrise at 8:20 and set at 16:20, 8 hours. And Sligo, Northwest Ireland, you saw the sunrise at 8:55 and set at 16:20, giving a day of 7 hours and 25. The moon is new on Thursday, the 11th of January. Watch it growing in your skies, as it will be full on Thursday, the 25th, and it is known as the moon after Yule. Believe it or not, there is still food to be foraged in January. You can find chickweed, hairy bittercress, wintercress, also known as creases, garlic mustard, three-cornered leek, sow thistle, sea beet, and the famous January rock star, the velvet shank mushroom. You'll find them in the depths of winter on rotting tree stumps, where you'll see their large, dense tears brightly glistening and golden. So today's place of the month is also a somewhat literary inspired one, like the previous month. So we're heading to Ballylee in County Galway, Ireland. The reason we're heading here is due to it featuring in W.B. Yeats's famous The Celtic Twilight from 1893. This is a favourite read of mine. It's a very slim book, eminently readable, very accessible, and it's essentially a collection of local people's memories, a collection of folklore. But it's recorded by Yeats in a very conversational manner, and because he's obviously a celebrated writer, he also brings a great deal of imaginative and literary prowess to these recordings. Even the people whose memories he's describing, they themselves seem to burst off the page. It feels like many different scraps of memories all woven together in a feverish, dreamy way. Anyway, this book and Yeats's wider folkloric work will be covered in the main Folkway show another time, because there is so much to say, including some criticisms too. But for now, we're travelling to a secluded fold of the Galway countryside, a hamlet where Yeats recalls a striking tower, the curative properties of the water, and memories of one of the most beautiful women to have ever walked, Mary Hines, the ruins of her house being here. I'm going to read directly from the book. So this is page 19 from my edition by Prism Press. So this is what Yeats had to say about this hamlet as the 1900s were beckoning. I've been lately to a little group of houses, not many enough to be called a village, in Kiltartan in County Galway, whose name, Ballylee, is known through all the west of Ireland. There is the old square castle, inhabited by a farmer and his wife, and a cottage where their daughter and their son-in-law live, and a little mill with an old miller, and old ash trees throwing green shadows upon a little river and great stepping stones. I went there two or three times last year to talk to the miller about Biddy Early, a wise woman that lived in County Clare some years ago, and about her saying that, quote, there is a cure for all evil between the two mill wheels of Ballylee. And to find out from the miller, or another, whether Biddy meant the moss between the running waters, or some other herb. I've been there this summer, and I shall be there again before it is autumn, because Mary Hines, a beautiful woman whose name is still a wonder by turf fires, died there in Ballylee 60 years ago. For our feet would linger where beauty has lived its life of sorrow, to make us understand that it is not of the world. An old man brought me a little way from the mill and the castle, and down a long, narrow boreen that was nearly lost in brambles and sloe bushes, and he said, "That is the little old foundation of the house. But the most of it is taken for building walls, and the goats have ate those bushes that are growing over till they've got cranky, and they won't grow any more. They say she was the handsomest girl in Ireland. Her skin was like dribbled snow." And Yeats interjects to say that he probably meant driven snow, perhaps. And that, quote, she had blushes in her cheeks. She had five handsome brothers, but all are gone now. I talked to him about a poem in Irish that Raftery, a famous poet, had made about Mary, and how it said that, quote, there is a strong cellar in Ballylee. The miller said that the strong cellar was the great hole where the river sank underground, and he brought me to a deep pool where an otter hurried away under a grey boulder, and told me that many fish came up out of the dark water at early morning to taste the fresh water coming down from the hills. So I first heard of this poem in Irish from an old woman who lives about 2 miles further up the river and who is old enough to remember Raftery and Mary Hines. The old woman says, quote, I never saw anybody so handsome as she was, and I never will till I die. And also that the poet Raftery was nearly blind and had no way of living but to go round and to mark some house to go to, and then all the neighbours would gather to hear him. If you treated him well, he'd praise you, but if you did not, he'd fault you in Irish. He was the greatest poet in Ireland, she said, and he'd make a song about a bush if he chanced to stand under it. There was a bush he stood under from the rain, and he made verses praising it. And then when the water came through, he made verses dispraising it. She sang Raftery's poem to a friend and to myself in Irish, and every word was audible and expressive. The friend that was with me has made some of the translation, but some of it has been made by the country people themselves. Going to Mass by the will of God, the day came wet and the wind rose. I met Mary Hines at the cross of Kiltartan, and I fell in love with her then and there. I spoke to her kind and mannerly, as by report was her own way, and she said, "Raftery, my mind is easy, you may come today to Ballylee." When I heard her offer, I did not linger. When her talk went to my heart and my heart rose, we had only to go across the three fields, we had daylight with us, to Ballylee. The table was laid with glasses and a quart measure. She had fair hair, and she sitting beside me, and she said, "Drink, and 100 welcomes, there is a strong cellar in Ballylee." There is sweet air on the side of the hill when you are looking down upon Ballylee. When you are walking in the valley picking nuts and blackberries, there is music of the birds in it and music of the she. There was no part of Ireland I did not travel, from the rivers to the tops of the mountains, to the edge of Loch Green, whose mouth is hidden, and I saw no beauty that was beyond hers. Her hair was shining, and her brows were shining too. Her face was like herself, her mouth pleasant and sweet. She is the pride, and I gave her the branch. She is the shining flower of Ballylee. An old weaver, whose son is supposed to go away among the she, and the she, of course, are the fairies. You may have picked up on, in the poem, this line when describing Ballylee: there is music of the birds in it, and music of the she, the fairies. So yeah, back to this old weaver, who says, quote, "Mary Hines was the most beautiful thing ever made. My mother used to tell me about her, for she'd be at every hurling, and wherever she was dressed in white. As many as 11 men asked her in marriage in one day, but she wouldn't have any of them. There was a lot of men up beyond Kilbecanty one night, sitting together drinking and talking of her, and one of them got up and set out to go to Ballylee and see her, but Clune Bog was open then, and when he came to it, he fell into the water, and they found him dead there in the morning." Another old man says he was only a child when he saw her, but he remembered that, quote, "the strongest man that was amongst us, one John Madden, got his death of the head of her. Cold he got crossing rivers in the night time to get to Ballylee." And Yeats notes that this is perhaps the man that other remembered, for tradition gives the one thing many shapes. Yeats continues that there is an old woman who remembers her at Derry Brian among the Echt Hills, a vast desolate place. The old woman says, quote, "the sun and the moon never shone on anybody so handsome, and her skin was so white that it looked blue, and she had two little blushes on her cheeks. And an old wrinkled woman who lives close to Ballylee and has told me many tales of the she says, quote, I often saw Mary Hines, and she was handsome indeed. She had two bunches of curls beside her cheeks, and they were the colour of silver. I saw Mary Malloy that was drowned in the river beyond, and Mary Guthrie that was in Ardrahan. But Mary took the sway of them both, a very comely creature. I was at her wake too. She had seen too much of the world. She was a kind creature. Yeats continues that those who are much admired are, it is held, taken by the she. An old man who lives by the sea at Duras has as little doubt that she was taken, and that she died young because the gods loved her, for the she are the gods. These poor countrymen and countrywomen, in their beliefs and in their emotions, are many years nearer to that old Greek world that set beauty beside the foundation of things than are men of learning. And Yeats concludes that it may be that in a few years, Fable, who changes mortalities to immortalities in her cauldron, will have changed Mary Hynes and Raftery to perfect symbols of the sorrow of beauty and of the magnificence and penury of dreams. I think that's quite an astute comment from Yeats at the end. So, with Mary Hynes of Ballylee, we've got the earthly, fleshy beauty of a woman who is so beautiful that she has become mythologized and therefore somewhat unearthly. But we've also got the place, Ballylee, the backdrop. We've got pleasing depictions of the scenery, but also that it is somewhat otherworldly. To quote the line from the poem again, when describing Ballylee, there is music of the birds in it and music of the she. And this place, Ballylee, seems to also colour the romantic depictions of Mary, therefore, in this buoyant natural area, and vice versa too. The ghost of Mary's beauty impacts the landscape, perhaps gives it an extra special air. This seems to be part of the reason why Yeats is so moved by this area, indeed why he later came to purchase the tower here. Yeah, there's a synergy here. The beautiful landscape, the beauty of the woman, but also a sense of the other world, a synergy that the strange depths of the human heart can conjure and appreciate. So there is a tower at Ballylee that Yeats purchased and lived here, it forming a backdrop to many of his poetic and occult endeavours. And to further the point I just made, the Tower House therefore seems to have carried sacred associations to Yeats with poetry, with a legendary beauty who brought sorrow in her wake, but also with the folklore and history of this beautiful part of Ireland. So that is January's place of the month, Ballylee, and how through Yeats's lens we get to romantically see the aching longing of the human condition married to this fold of Galway.
You have to be right, and the time has to be right.